The following is a duplicate of tape 1, side 2, of an interview with Victor Sen Yung, conducted for the Southern California Chinese American Oral History Project.
I do, when I have the time, I read a lot. I don't now, I mean, mostly political essays. I like to read up, keep up on the activities now, the current events, and what's happening in the world. Of course, see, the first 2 years that I worked in motion pictures, the first 3 years when I was under contract at Fox, I went to USC and took the graduate courses in cinematography, film production, and motion picture production, film editing. Because I didn't know anything about the business, and I wanted to understand what I'm doing. It's like, you know, to understand terminology. If you're going to sew a dress, you got to know all the terminology of like a needle, what does a needle do, and all that. And the other thing that I did was to go to a design school under the GI Bill of Rights when I came back out of the service. So I spent 2 years in Lipson School of Costume Design, and I learned how to cut, make, and trim. I'm a tailor and designer, but I never got to use that because I felt that I could sell the suits faster than I could make them. So my main concern, my main activity, I would say I'm interested in sales mostly and public relations work.
Now, since you don't have any relatives left in China, you're never have to write to them, or you have no connection with them whatsoever.
I have a strong desire to go to Fatsan. I missed the trip.
Which is your?
My father's place of origin. Our family, Sen, is a very small family, the name that is. Mm-hmm. And I understand that there's quite a few prominent families in Fatsan, and that's where my father came from. I would like to go back and find out if there are any other relatives. I know there is one man in Hong Kong of the same family named Sen, who is a very prominent attorney. Then there was a singer, Sin Gum Lai.
About this attorney in Hong Kong, yes, Sin.
Sin?
Sin Bing Hei.
Is that his name?
Well, if
Sin Bing Hei.
Victor, what about your associations in Chinatown now? Do you know many friends there?
Well, not now. I mean, I know a lot of people who have a lot of so-called friends. I think I can identify them as friends. But my, because of, I would say, economic necessity, and because of my particular working habits, which take me all over the country, I don't find the time to get down to Chinatown and mingle with the people there. And then, of course, the other thing is that a great majority of them that I used to associate with are no longer there. The ones that I do know or did know are in business, like Frank and Wally Kwan of the Grand Star. They're about the closest people I know down there. Then there's Arthur Wong out in the valley, who has the Far East Terrace. They're scattered. They're becoming fewer and fewer.
Do you remember what Chinatown looked like when you first came down?
Oh, yes.
What year did you come down?
1930, actually, the first time I came down was in 1934.
34, all right.
Came down for a football game.
What did Chinatown look like then? Do you remember?
Well, it was very old, and then it had one main street called Marshall Street. It was across on the east side of Alameda. Very narrow, and then these old, really old, early American-type buildings.
Is that the street Massasoit still there now?
No, it's now occupied by the parking lot of the Union Station.
I see.
They tore that whole area down to build the Union Station. Now, in retrospect, they should never have done it because Union Station isn't used anymore.
So, and what else about Chinatown that you remember way
the
back
the restaurants. Then? And then there were those days I was starting to as they say, ball it up and get associated with people in the bars, the piano bars especially, which you don't see very many of. I remember a guy down there named Frank Wilson, who used to play the piano down there. Then there was, that was torn. Now, in 1938, they tore that down. I mean, they started to build the Union Station. And, what's his name now? Suhu, the older one. Peter Suhu.
Peter.
He headed an organization to build the new Chinatown up on North Broadway. He had a lot of foresight. They developed that, the new Chinatown. Now, there was another faction, business-wise. Tommy Gubbins was one of them, who are part of the old Chinatown. So they decided to, they, in conjunction with a woman, I think her name was Hill, from the Los Angeles Times, developed an area called China City. And that was on, across from Olvera Street on Spring and Ord, where, you know, Yi Mi Lu's restaurant is.
Oh, yeah. You mean that small place,
yeah,
back of Yi Mi Lu now.
Right. Well, it was it was bigger than that at that time. It extended as far to almost to Sunset Boulevard. Now, that was called China City. Then there was New Chinatown. Now, a lot of people identify that with as Old Chinatown, but that's not. Old Chinatown is where the Union Station was.
Now, this China City that you mentioned a little while ago, is it still in existence now?
No, it's not. There are a few of the stores that were a little more substantial that are still remaining there. It's become a rather, it's not identified so much as China City, but it's now all Chinatown. Mm-hmm. Now, the other section of the Chinese section was down on San Pedro, down by the market, 9th and San Pedro.
9th Street and
9th
San
Street
Pedro.
9th Street and San Pedro, okay. Around that area. There are a few big restaurants there, but grocery stores and, but there's a fish market there. Now, that was another section, so-called, of Chinatown. And that was basically because in those days, there were, in the earlier days, the produce section was actually dominated and controlled by the Chinese and the Japanese. So they had a thriving Oriental business population going in and out of there and patronizing those Chinese businesses. So there was actually, there's four areas where Chinatown has been.
At that time, uh-huh.
Yeah.
So even at that time, even though your work did not carry you to Chinatown, but did you make frequent visits there?
Oh, yes. Yes. I go down there at least every other week to shop, to buy my groceries, condiments, Chinese vegetables. The variety of produce you can get in Chinatown is the best. The meat you can get in Chinatown is the best and the most reasonable. You know, the cuts you have, don't have all these fancy cuts that are wrapped in cellophane, you know. You go down and see what you want and you order it by the pound. Then I go home and cut it up myself and wrap it in cellophane and freeze it.
So as far as you know, which is the most influential or prominent Chinese in L.A.? Well, during the Second World War?
Oh, I say in Los Angeles, I would say, of course, you would say the produce section, that group. A lot of them I didn't know. There was Y.C. Hong, an attorney, who was very prominent, and of course, Peter Suhu. Tommy Gubbins, of course.
Why did you say Y.C. Hong was that important?
Because he was also instrumental in the organization of that new Chinatown group.
Along with
Peter Suhu. Mm-hmm. A matter of fact, his building is one of the buildings there. I think it's right in the middle of that street, right up from Hong Kong Lao.
Yes. As a matter of fact, he owns all that big
Y.C.
section.
Hong?
Y.C. Hong's building, Hong Kong Lao.
Yeah.
And all that. Now then, as far as you know, what kind of jobs were most Chinese engaged in before the war, before the Second World War?
Of course, the only a lot of them were working in markets,
produce.
Some of them got as far as working in the front end, the retail, the canned goods or dry foods. I think in Los Angeles, they were scattered more, and their versatility was exemplified more in the variety of jobs they were able to pursue.
Why was that?
Now, there were architects, there were prominent doctors, orthodontists, real estate. They branched out into other areas which, aside from those confined to Chinatown, I mean, say for instance, a real estate person in development, for instance, land development.
Now, before the Second World War, there were nobody doing that, I don't suppose.
There were a few, yes, down in Los Angeles, in Los Angeles, and down in the South, down through Arizona, and
Arizona, yes.
You see, there were a few that had supermarkets, and they went into, they did in San Francisco too, as far as they were picked for sales, say for instance, in an automobile company on the sales force. Because they were Chinese, not because they were Chinese, but because the automobile company hoped that he would bring in the Chinese trade from Chinatown, because it was a very important market as far as population.
Mm-hmm. Now, but right in Chinatown, though, what would you say was the average income before the Second World War that the Chinese were making?
I have no idea, because I never was involved in working in Chinatown.
Mm-hmm. All right. Then, do you happen to know what people did with the money, the Chinese? Did most of them gamble them away? Or
a lot of them gambled. A lot of them saved their money and put it in real estate. A lot of them, I think, sent money home. I don't think as many returned to China, so-called went back, as we say, went back to China, as did previously, because of the political situation and everything in China. They chose to remain in the United States.
Do you happen to know anyone involved in Chinese politics?
In China?
In China.
Yes.
Who?
I don't know his name now. His name is Tong. I'll tell you who he was. He was the Secretary General that went to the United Nations from China. Matter of fact, we were roommates for a year in college, in my sophomore year.
Too bad you don't remember the name, huh? Well, maybe it'll come back to you pretty soon. Now, in Chinatown, did most Chinese live near other Chinese? Do you happen to know the Chinese? Were they living together in Chinatown?
Not in Los Angeles, not so much. They were spread more.
Now
see,
they do.
Now there's more. The housing development is beginning to materialize in and around Chinatown, but these are primarily the Chinese from China.
Mm-hmm. True.
See, but Los Angeles was unique in that respect, that the Chinese, most of them, had homes that were scattered all over Southern California. I mean, in the southern area of town. Whereas in San Francisco and New York, they were confined, if they were living in China, to tenements.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we did.
Now, where were you during the Depression in Los Angeles?
Oh, no. You mean, I was going to school.
Oh, you were going to school.
That'd be 29.
Yeah, 30,
oh, yeah,
31,
29, 30, 31. Yeah,
you
I was going to school.
When
I was working my way, working as a houseboy.
Now, all the years you have lived in, let's say, San Francisco, around that neighborhood, or Los Angeles, did you ever feel there were hostility towards you or towards Chinese?
I mean, from the standpoint of race?
Yes. Have you personally felt any
hostility? Haven't. Matter of fact, it's been the other way, I think. Maybe it's because the only time I actually get down there and get involved with the public is during the festivals like Chinese New Year or Moon Festival.
At work, at your movie work.
Yeah, it's very compatible because there's a lot of respect, especially among the the people that work on the set. Because as an actor, you're supposed to be able to perform and bring something to the production, and you're treated a lot differently. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like if you're working as a clerk in the back room of a grocery store, you know, it's a little different. Although I would say a lot of times those clerks make more money than we do, you know.
Now then, would you consider the Chinese to have done better or worse in general compared with the other populations? Have we advanced as much as other people?
Of course, it's hard to say. I'm saying this candidly. We have not, in comparison, say, to the blacks, we have not had the support, whether it be funding or whatever it is, that the blacks have to improve their situation. We've done it by our own bootstraps, pulling up our own bootstraps. But I think the Chinese, generally speaking, have come much further, aside from the Jewish people, I would say, because I don't know that much about them. But from where we were, say, economically and politically and influence, say, 20 years ago or 30 years ago, we've come a long ways, mm-hmm. as a group, as a whole. There are more professional men, there are more, again, I would say, I would go back to the influence of the older people who insist and direct and guide the younger people to pursue these professions.
So in your way of thinking, the family influence is very, very important.
Absolutely, absolutely. If not the family, it's got, I would say, it's a philosophy of life, an attitude towards work, intelligence. Whether it comes from the church, whether it comes from the family, whether it comes from an older brother, an uncle, that discipline, that influence has to be there to direct and guide the youngsters as they grow up.
Now, you mentioned a little while ago that you didn't know too much about how the Jewish people fare. Is that right?
I don't know too much.
Ask you, compare the Chinese with the Jewish people, who's doing better, you know?
Well, it's difficult to say, because if you take percentage of population, I think the Chinese are doing as well, if not better. But then the Jewish people, there's so much to say, they control so much, and then their population is much greater than the Chinese population in the United States. I don't think we have more, we would say we have 500,000. Chinese in the United States? Not even that.
I have no idea.
See, as compared, I was saying, like mm-hmm. the blacks, let's say it's 20% of the population. And it's a weight. The Chinese, in terms of contribution, in terms of percentage of population, have done more.
Oh, much.
Much more.
Much.
And suffered more, actually. Suffered more. Ding dong, you know, keep going. But it's got to come, I think, from, yes, there's a pride in heritage, there's a pride, a great pride in the fact that I am of Chinese blood, and the appreciation of the fact that, I say I revert to my father because he was the only one here to push me on, his influence.
Now, about, you know, going back to the Chinese family, were the American-born Chinese just as eager to have sons than daughters as their parents? Now, you're a young man, you were born here. Would you rather have a couple of sons than a couple of daughters?
Makes no difference.
I see. But how about your father?
Do My father, I think... No, I don't think he had that attitude either. I think he was more concerned about... My father, in this respect, I think was quite interesting. His closest friends were Caucasian. Mm. There was Dr. Glover, there was Mrs. Ziley, who was with the Baptist Church. There was a customer of his that he got to know and became very close, a correspondent every month. J.C. Mead, a fan in Chicago. There was C. Victor Miller, an importer, a Jewish man in New York. And there was George Creel, who was at one time the editor of the Collier's Magazine. And this is the statue. These are my father. They would look him up. They'd have tea, go to lunch, have dinner. Mm. Aside from that, it's all work. Of course, his Pico and all that was the Sportsman's Club. I mean, that was his recreation. Mm-hmm. But that had nothing to do with his actual, his economic activity.
Mm-hmm. Now then, what do you think of interracial marriage?
At one time, I thought it wasn't too good. Because I had a very conceited idea that the Chinese were the best in the world. But being an American Chinese and having been brought up in the public education system of the United States and being a part of the American society, you have to think of it in terms of we are all Americans. So as a matter of preference is not one of choice of the parent, I think, maybe guidance as far as the parent is concerned, but it has to be more or less the choice of the youngsters with the correct guidance again to make sure that they have a good marriage. Mm-hmm. If they don't love each other, if it's infatuation, that's one thing. How do they know? So I think with interracial marriages, they should be a little more cautious.
I see. For the simple reason that they are from a little bit different...
Different backgrounds. And not only that, the important thing is what effect is it going to have on the children if they bring children into the world? Mm-hmm. Not so much the grandparents, but the children.
Now, because you're speaking from experience, since you have a daughter-in-law that is not 100% Chinese. And
a granddaughter. My daughter-in-law is English and Scotch. She's American. Mm-hmm. Then on my sister's side, her daughter is married to an Italian, American-born. So they have Italian-Chinese combination, and ours is, on my side, the grandchildren are Scotch-Irish and Chinese. I think that the thing that is difficult to accept, I mean, I wouldn't say typical to accept, but I think it's tragic that it's not no longer a thing, but can be, is bilingual, being bilingual. Mm-hmm. I think that say, for instance, my grand-nephews, being of Italian and Chinese blood, should be able to speak three languages, mm-hmm. Italian, Chinese, and English.
So, now, when you were small, did you go to Chinese school at all?
1 year.
One year only. Why, just 6 months?
I got a job. Working as a houseboy, I couldn't afford to go to school.
Would you like to see your grandchildren attend Chinese school if there's a possibility?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. I think from the standpoint, there's a discipline in learning how to write Chinese characters. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of discipline in that.
How many people do you know ultimately would like to return to China to live in their home?
I don't know of any.
You don't know of any?
Mm-hmm. I would like
would
to live there.
Would you like to go back and live permanently?
I would,
permanently?
Yes. Not permanently. I would like to go back and live, say, 6 months out of the year if I had a business set up so
well,
I could travel.
Well, that's only a traveling, but I was thinking that would you like to go back there and live until you die? To live permanently?
Well, I can't say because I haven't been there.
I see.
When I go there and look the situation over, I might think differently because I might feel that I, at this stage in life, might be able to contribute more over there than I do here.
I see. So you definitely would like to make a trip there to see what's going on?
Absolutely, yes.
Mm-hmm. Are you planning on it?
Yes, I think in the fall or midsummer. Again, I'll try that trip. Actually, the first trip I make, I just want to go. It's a troop goes to Guangzhou only.
Mm. Oh.
And so they go a couple of days, like 3 or 4 days in Hong Kong, and then they go across the border and take the train, and then Guangzhou, Fatsan, and hit all those little villages. You know, mm-hmm. That'd be enough. The rest, you know, when it comes to Shanghai, Beijing, Suzhou, all that, that to me is a tourist thing, mm-hmm. you know. It's beautiful to see and all that, but my identity is still going to be in Guangzhou, Canton. Mm-hmm.
Now, since you have been in the movie business all your life, what do you think of the Chinese when they portray characters that are, some people feel that is degrading or not true to a Chinese way of life?
If it's demeaning, it's difficult. Let me go back to the Charlie Chan series, and there's a big controversy now on a show that's being done in San Francisco, Charlie Chan and the Dragon Lady, with Peter Ustinov. Oh. Now, in the earlier days when Warner Oland and Sidney Toler and Roland Witters did the character, they did it from a specific mold, but I thought the shows were very entertaining.
No, but I mean, I'm talking about the character of the Chinese that the movie people portray that is not exactly what the Chinese would like to accept.
Oh, I don't think, in this day and age, I don't think it's right, unless it's a satire and is accepted as such. That's what I'm saying. I was trying to make a comparison between the early Chans and Peter Ustinov. Now, they tried another one with Ross Martin, and it didn't make it. They shot it, and they had to shelve it.
Now, for instance, like many times they portray a Chinese wearing a pointed hat, just like a coolie hat or the
Mandarin
type hat with the long hair and walk kind of funny like. You know, the Chinese, most Chinese thought that that was not the thing to a Chinese should be.
No, it's not true. Mm-hmm. I believe in true characterization.
Yeah.
I think it's better. I mean, the that's what I'm saying. The Peter Ustinov, the way they got him made up, he's got this long mustache and all. He looks more like Fu Manchu, mm-hmm. the old image of Fu Manchu. Now I don't know
but
what
Chinese
he's speaking.
Chinese don't look like that anymore.
No, I think it's wrong. Again, I say if it's done for the purpose of theatrics, like mm-hmm. you take the Chinese opera, where they make up and they have these long beards and they dance and the red face, black face, white face. But that's theatrical, mm-hmm. aside. Now, you accept it as being theatrical. That's one thing, whether it be a ballet or it could be, you know, on stage that way. But when you're talking in terms of a natural human being, let's compare old Ironsides. Mm-hmm. Ironsides, what's his name? You know, the detective Ironsides with Peter Ustinov as Charlie Chan. One is a caricature and the other is a human being.
I see.
So it's like looking at the Chinese and saying they're all cartoon characters. I mean, they might as well make it Mickey Mouse, you know. Mm-hmm. At least Mickey Mouse is accepted as a character, as a cartoon. Mm-hmm. Well, why should they make Chinese that way? In the olden days, it was accepted because that was the way it was sold, the pictures were sold. But this is a different generation. This is a different era. And this is a different world of understanding. And the only way we can do it and to be understood and to accept people realistically is to accept them as they are, as human beings.
So in other words, you seem to tell me that from now on, the Chinese parts will not be played like
They shouldn't. Unless it, you know, I mean, I go into the character like I didn't. Here's the difference now. There were some repercussions, but not much. But there was on a commercial I did, because I did it in the character of the cook on the Bonanza show. Mm-hmm. Now, to be true, historically, the show Bonanza is in the late 1800s, that mm-hmm. period. Early California, early Nevada. The Chinese in those days wore the costume like that.
Yes.
They wore the queue.
Yeah, that's right.
It's true to history.
Uh-huh.
It's true to history.
But unfortunately, many Chinese of today have never seen Chinese like that.
True. It's true. But if it's going to be set in a different period, let me see, the studios have a problem because they want to be authentic.
Uh-huh.
Bonanza could be shot in a modern day like Big Valley. Then they could have a Chinese working there without the queue and all that. But the language, the spoken language, you can't get away from, because there's a certain element, depending upon the delivery they call it pidgin English, which is humorous. But it's not ridicule. It's humorous, but it's loving. The character on the show, I thought, was a wonderful character.
So you say any time that a Chinese on a show, the way they had portrayed it, it was all right. It all depends how you interpret it.
I say the thing is, depends on when the show was made and how it's interpreted. Yes, the period of time, number one, and when they shot the picture.
I never thought of it that way, but I can see it. Now, what kind of jobs would most Chinese consider to be ideal for their children and their
ideal
grandchildren? The kind of jobs that people look up to among the children.
Well, always it's the professional. Doctors, dentists, lawyer. Doctors and dentists first. I think doctors first, dentists, and then lawyers. Businessmen.
Mm-hmm.
You know.